Morning. We are wrapping up a four-week little study in the book of Haggai. It's one of the minor prophets in the Old Testament, but it is a timeless book, and it is a timely book for us, I believe, in the day and the season that we live in, because it is the season of promise making, as we're going to talk about this morning, the fame of God and the promise of God. It is the season for promise making because it is primary season, right? It is primary season. So if you watch whatever network you watch, whatever news network you're affiliated with, whatever one you sort of watch to kind of balance out the other one, you know it is primary season. And during primary season, politicians are making promises to all kinds of people in all kinds of places, right? So lots of promises. So they get into buses or they get on their planes or whatever they have, and they go to different counties, some rural, some suburban, some really kind of urban. They go to all these places, diners. They go to rallies. They make all kinds of promises, all kinds of different people in different places about all kinds of different things. And people show up to listen because the promises that they're talking about affect people's lives in significant ways, right? So they affect our education or the education of our kids or our healthcare or whatever it might be. So today is not necessarily the time for sort of some kind of political discourse, but it is the season for promise making, where we are hearing so many promises and then we're seeing so few of them kept, right? And it's interesting because it's really playing out in the way that this primary season is shaping up. Like, there is a bunch of characters in the mix that, well, people didn't really imagine would be necessarily in the mix. Like, voters are sort of functioning in a different way than they have in the past. And the pundits will all say it's because people are tired of the status quo and they're tired of people acting the way they've always acted. They're tired of politicians doing what they've always done. And what have they always done? Well, they've always made lots of promises and kept very few. The good news that we have for this morning is that we serve a God who always makes good on his promises. And he uses them to point us to his goodness, to show his goodness to us, to make his goodness known to us. And so as we live in a world that is filled with broken promises, and as half of our marriages end because of a broken promise, and as business deals go bad because of broken promises, and friendships are broken because of broken promises, and nations crumble and they're in turmoil because of broken promises. Look, we live in the midst of a day of broken promises. We have a God who makes good on his promises, and he uses those promises is to make his goodness known to us. And at the Village Church, we always want to share good news with you. And I believe that is our good news for this morning. God makes a lot of promises to his people. So if God's going to always make good on his promises, that's a big thing because he makes a lot of promises. So some people have kind of tried to go through the Bible and say, how many promises does God actually make? One person came up with 3,573. 3,573. So that must have been a long read through the Bible, right? It's like very long read, very detailed read, looking for every promise of God. The first person that did that put in a lot of time. So depending on how you define a promise and what actually the promise is, 3,573, some people say there's over 7,000, right? So I think that's like the name it and claim it side, right? That's like, you're supposed to laugh at that. That's like the people, right? They want more promises that they can claim, right? So 7,000 promises. So whether it's 3,000 or 7,000 or somewhere in between, let's just say God makes lots of promises, thousands of promises to his people. And so if God makes thousands of promises to his people, how could we really say God always makes good on his promises? And how could we really know that? And in the political term, in terms of talking points, I think this morning, God's going to give us three talking points. He's going to boil all of his promises, whether there's 3,573 or 7,000 plus one, wherever you're coming from, he's going to boil all of those promises down to just three promises this morning. And it's amazing, again, how timely this stuff is and how timeless it is. It's amazing how much these three promises, they paint the story of the gospel. They tell us the story of salvation history, how God has been at work and how he is at work and how he will be at work. He boils all of these promises down to three things, three simple promises. I got to warn you that you might want to sort of fasten up your seatbelt for the first one because it's not a promise that you're going to be expecting. It's going to jerk you here for a moment. You're going to feel this, okay? So the promises of God, the first of the three is this: your sin is greater than you think. That's the first promise that God gives to his people. I told you, you weren't going to expect that this morning. Your sin is greater than you think. I promise. I promise that your sin is greater than you think. That's what God is telling the people in Haggai's day. He's saying your sin is greater than you think. It's more contagious than you think. Like it's caught easier than you think it is. You rub up against people and they catch your sin and you catch theirs. It is, you are contaminated and you are contaminating others. You so easily catch the sin. It so easily contaminates your life. And he does that by employing this analogy from the Old Testament. So in the Old Testament, in the book of Leviticus in particular, God lays out all kinds of laws. Ceremonial laws, religious laws, and the like. And look, the whole point of it is to display God's holiness and our unholiness, right? So if you're like me right now, you're reading through the book of Leviticus, right? If you're in your one-year Bible reading plan and you're going through a certain plan, you're in the book of Leviticus right now, and so you understand what I'm talking about. And you're tempted every morning to get up with your cup of coffee and just go, I'm going to skip to the Psalms, right? Skip to Psalms and Proverbs. Look, read Leviticus. Like as hard and as painful, forgive me, Lord, sometimes as it might be, read through Leviticus, because what it does is, as a whole, it paints this picture saying, God is tremendously holy, and you are wholly unholy. And so what Leviticus does is it shows us that. And so in the book of Leviticus, God is showing us all these laws, and they seem weird, some of them. Like this one is like, hey, there's this garment that the priest wears. And so there's this meat that's holy. It's supposed to be devoted to the Lord, sacrificed to him. And so it's put in like the hem of the garment, right? And so as the priest goes along, like what happens to that holy meat? Like if it touches something that's unholy, like if I bump up next to someone who lied today, like do they become holy now because they touched the holy meat that was in the hem of the garment? He goes on to explain it this way on the 24th day of the month. Let me say it exactly as he says it. The Lord says this. Ask the priest about the law. If someone carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches with his fold bread or stew or wine or oil or any kind of food, does it become holy? So is that the way it works? Like you got this holy meat in your hem and you touch something else. Does what you touch become holy? Can you communicate holiness? Is holiness communicable? That's the question. The priest says, no, it doesn't work like that. And then he goes on to ask another question. Haggai says, look, if someone who is unclean by contact with a dead body, some other example, touches any one of these. So you don't touch a dead body because it kind of contaminates or pollutes you. This whole idea of holiness and separation and cleanliness that's going on in the book of Leviticus. Does it become unclean? And this time the priest answers, yes, it does become unclean. So the idea is like holiness doesn't transfer, but unholiness does. Like it's far easier to spread sin than to spread righteousness, far easier to spread vice than to spread virtue, like far easier for us to be contaminated than for us to make others healthy. Like your sin is contagious. It is so contagious. You breathe it in all the time. It affects you constantly. There's nothing that you can do to protect yourself. You can't wear a mask. You can't put on a special suit. Like you're not immune. You're going to catch it. You have caught it. You are going to infect others with it. Israel's been living in a contaminated state, a state of a contamination because of their sin, so to speak. And as a result, everything they touch becomes contaminated. It's kind of like you don't take a healthy person who is well and put them into the infectious disease quarantine unit at the CDC and expect that healthy person is going to make all of those people with West Nile somehow healthy just because they're present with them. No, it doesn't work like that. She works in the opposite direction. That healthy person goes into the lockdown and they become unhealthy. It's kind of like jumping in a mud puddle with a pair of wet Vans. Anyone on Instagram following Danny? See his white Vans? Yeah, some of you. So Danny's got Vans, man, and they're white, and it is every week is you know, every day his friend's like, hey, Danny, you know, and so Danny's got his white. What if Danny jumps in a puddle of muddle with his white Vans? What happens to Danny's Vans? Like they become muddied. Danny jumps in the puddle and the puddle doesn't turn white. Like the puddle doesn't become clean. On Danny's Vans, they get all dirty, they get all muddy. Like that's the way that it works. Sin is contagious, it spreads so quickly. He says it's not only contagious, it's complete. Your sin is not only contagious, it's complete. It's not only more contagious than you think it is, it's more complete than you think it is. Like it encompasses, it's all encompassing. Haggai goes on to say, so it is with these people and with this nation before me, declares the Lord. And so with every work of their hands, every work of their hands, and what they offer there is unclean. He's saying everything that they do is tainted with sin. And theologians have tried to come up with a term to describe this, a way to describe this. One of the terms is total depravity or radical corruption. This idea that sin affects every aspect of our being. It affects our bodies. It affects our soul, our mind, our will, our emotions, all tainted, affected by sin. Sin penetrates to the very core of who we are, at the deepest levels of who we are. Like a tree whose roots are all diseased, then making the trunk diseased and making all of the branches diseased, and every tree on the branch, every leaf on the branch of every branch on that tree diseased. So sin affects all of our lives. It pervades all of us from those diseased roots. Or like leaven finds its way into a loaf of a ball of dough on a table in a kneading pin. And then when it's put in the oven, that leaven, it leavens the whole lump. The Bible says a little leaven leavens the whole lump. It just pervades the whole thing. The whole bread becomes infested with the yeast. So our entire lives are affected by sin. And just like one little drop of dark red food coloring can totally change the consistency, the color can affect a glass of clean water, taint it, make it unclean. So our entire lives are tainted by sin so that we have become completely unclean. And the idea here is that it's not that we can't do more sin. Oh, we can do more sin, and often we prove that we can. And it's not that we can't sin in worse ways. No, often we prove that, no, there are worse ways to sin, and we do. It means that everything we do, everything we put our hand to, every religious activity included, everything that we do is tainted by sin to one degree or another. We have become unclean. God's saying, look, your sin is greater than you think it is. I promise you. I promise you it is. This word unclean, it means defiled or polluted. Maybe those are easy handles for this word unclean or uncleanliness, but it also means infamous. That's interesting. That this word unclean, it means infamous. The word infamous means to have an extremely bad reputation, right? To be ill-famed. And it's interesting that we're talking about the fame of God. This series is called The Famous One. And we're talking about the fame and the glory and the renown of God. And this word is talking about our fame, that we are ill-famed. We are famous for our ill. We are famous for our sin. And just like a hit song makes a star famous, or someone that's on American Idol, they're going to be famous soon. A painting makes an artist famous. It could just be one, but if it's that one, like, it can do it. A quick post on Instagram or Facebook, a YouTube video could make someone famous in a worldly, very, very superficial sense. Like, we have become famous for our sin. Like, that is what makes us famous. We are ill-famed. We're unclean. If you're not convinced yet, and if you wouldn't be convinced just to look at this and say, hey, look, this is a minor prophet, it's in the Old Testament, it's this one little thing, it's this one little word, like, is it really that deep? Is it really that big of a deal? I think people are mostly pretty good, like, you're painting a really dark picture. Look, the Old Testament uses eight examples, eight ways for us, eight ways that we have become infamous for our sin, eight ways, and it starts with something simple, and it kind of works its way down the line. And so when Haggai is telling them that all of their lives, everything they put their hands to is tainted by sin, he has all of these eight things in mind. He has the idea of sin and pollution, like in general in the Old Testament. This is what God is saying, like you've dove in headlong into the mud. You're dirty in all of these ways. The first way is called missing the mark. It's a word that you're probably familiar with. But we have to clarify that missing the mark is not just making a mistake. It's not just like, I blew it. Like, no, it's making a voluntary mistake, because missing the mark means that it's not just that we forgot to do something or we forgot God somehow. It's that we're focused on something else. So in the context of this series on fame and the fame of God, the renown of God, the glory of God, look, it's not just that we forgot about how famous God is or how much glory he has. No, we're looking on something else. Like when you drive a car and you look at something on the side of the road and you just begin to drift there. We willingly drift toward the thing that we're looking at, and what we're looking at is our own fame. The Bible goes on to talk about irreverence. This is the negative form of worship. So when we're up here, the band did a great job leading us this morning, and we take worship of God seriously. That's why they show up here at 6 o'clock in the morning and they practice and they pray and they get set to help lead God's people in worship of him through music. Like, we take that seriously. Irreverence is the opposite. It means taking God not so seriously. Like, not taking the fame of God seriously, being flippant about the fame of God. The third word the Old Testament uses as the progression goes on is transgression. It means literally to step over the line, right? So if we drew a line kind of in the sand right here, if God did and said, look, this is not sinful, but this is, 600 times the Bible references us going, oh, really, that's the line? I mean, that one right, you mean that one right there? Right, doing one of those. So in the context of the fame of God, you know, it's kind of like, oh, okay, so over here, this is stuff that makes you famous, and that's the stuff that makes me famous, and like, this is the line, right, you mean right there? And then we just do that to God. That's transgression. That's the fourth word that he uses is iniquity. It goes on, it gets worse. It's a lack of integrity. So it's not just that we aren't happy that God gets a lot of fame and that we don't. It's that in our hearts, we lack integrity about what we say about the fame of God. And iniquity would mean something like, in this context, that we don't want God, we actually don't want God to have fame, because we, in our hearts, we want the fame. That would be iniquity. Rebellion. We know that we should fear God and his fame, but we rebel against him instead, like a rebellious teenager who knows what's right and does what's wrong just to spite their parents, just to rebel against them. We rebel against God. The Old Testament talks about this idea of treachery, unfaithfulness, or untrustworthiness. Like, we know that God is the famous one, and we say that we're on his side, but then we act like traitors, and we betray him willingly. We act like spiritual double agents. The Bible goes on, there's more. It says perversion, to bend or to twist. There's a distortion of something that is good. And so we pervert things, even the fame of God. So we take the fame of God, which is a great thing, and we hold it up. And then what we do with it is we twist it somehow to bring fame ourselves instead of God. We pervert and twist the good and great fame of God, and we try to focus it back on ourselves. And the last one is a word you're probably familiar with, abomination. I mean, this is a term that refers specifically to the effect that sin has on God. That it makes him sick. It makes him nauseous. And so in all of these ways, when we blatantly tout our own fame above his, and we do it in his face and unrepentantly, it makes God sick to his stomach. Look, God is saying your sin is greater than you think. I promise. And the reason our sin is greater than we think is because we sin against a God who is greater than we think. We sin against a God who is greater than we think. So many times in the book of Haggai, it says, thus says the Lord, or this is what the Lord declares. The Lord, the existing one, the one who has always existed, the infinite one, the one that needs no one else, needs nothing else, self-existent, always there, in need of nothing, creator of everything. In comparison to him, we're like an electron in the atom on the back of an elephant. I mean, we are so small and he is so great. He controls the destiny of his people, the book of Haggai says. He controls the destiny of individuals. He controls the destiny of all of his people. The book of Haggai tells us he controls the destiny of nations. He actually raises up one nation and he puts down others. He controls nature. He can shake the heavens. He can shake creation to accomplish what he wants. I mean, this is the God that we sin against. And I can't help but think that that the people in Haggai's day knew exactly who they were sinning against, because, well, they looked back on the Exodus. They were celebrating the Feast of Booths, the time when God led them out of Egypt and they wandered in the wilderness. Like, they knew the story. Remember last week we said if there was any story they looked back to on God, about God's faithfulness, it was the Exodus from Egypt. It was their deliverance from Egypt. I mean, that's where they looked. And so they have to know this passage in Exodus 34 where Moses is up on the mountain. I mean, they have to be thinking about this. When they're thinking about their sin against God, they have to be thinking about God's self-disclosure of himself. Last week, there was a couple that showed up at our church, and they came to Connect Group, and one of them said, you know, hey, the reason we're here is because, like, we're here from another country, and we're here just for a couple of months, but in our country, there are not a lot of churches, and we're here because we want to know something about who God is. Came to the right place, I think, humbly, hopefully. So the people are saying, like, okay, this is who God is saying, this is who I am. So God makes this self-disclosure and said, the Lord passed by him and he says this, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Remember all those words we just talked about, but who by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and children's children to the third and the fourth generation. Look, I'm a God who is totally loving and totally just, completely merciful and completely just. I am more than you can wrap your mind around. I am more gracious than you think I am. God says, your sin is greater than you think. I promise. I promise. The question is, why does God spend so many verses here doing that? Like, in terms of the actual amount of verses that are in the book of Haggai, like, he spends a lot of time reminding them that they're blowing it. there's a lot of ink on those pages telling them how far they've fallen short. I mean, why does God spend so much time promising them that they are more sinful than they think? I mean, is it because he wants just to stick it to them? Like they just offended him and he wants to stick it to them. He just wants to make them feel it for the sake of feeling it. He wants to shame them somehow. He wants them to be ridden with guilt or something. He's got a bone to pick with them. He's got a point to make. Or maybe as you've talked with someone before about the existence of God and who he is and the person of Jesus Christ, and someone said, yeah, God seems really great. He seems really confident. Actually, he seems really insecure. He's always got to point out all our faults. Why? To make him feel better about himself or something? Make him feel good about himself? I mean, why does God reveal all of the depths of their sin to them? I think it is because he wants to set them up for the next promise. And if you know the storyline of the gospel of Jesus Christ, you know what the next promise is. It's not just that your sin is greater than you think, I promise, but it's that my grace is greater than you think. I promise. I promise you my grace is greater than you think it is. And to see that his grace is greater than you think, you first have to see that your sin is greater than you think. Right? I mean, the person who is most deeply aware of their sin is the one who most deeply appreciates the grace of God. The one who has sinned much loves much. And I believe this is ultimately the reason why God shows us the depth of our sin. I think this is the reason God would show us the depth of our sin. It has to be. It has to be at the end of the day. It has to be the reason God shows us the depth of our sin so that we can see the depth of his grace. So that we can see the depth of his grace. That's what he tells the people in Haggai's day. Starting in verse 15, look what he says. Now then, he says, consider three times. Consider from this day onward, before stone was placed upon stone in the temple of the Lord. How did you fare? How were you living? Disobedient. All of those eight things. When one came to a heap to get 20 measures, there were but 10. Like, you always fell short. When you came to a vat to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. You're always falling short. Why? God says, well, because I struck you. I struck you and all the products of your toil with blight and with mildew and with hail. Yet you did not turn to me, declares the Lord. He says again, consider this. Think about this. From this day onward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, since the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, he says it again, consider. Think about this. Just stop for a moment. Remember the first week he said, consider this. And I stopped all of us for a moment and said, hey, just stop for a second. Just stop and think about this for a moment. Just consider the depth of God's grace. As you consider the depth of your sin, he says, is the seed yet in the barn? Indeed, the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, and the olive tree have yielded what? Nothing. It's yielded nothing. Look, I'm trying to get your attention. And then God says this. This is so unbelievably beautiful. He says, but from this day on, I will bless you. But from this, what's in the vat? Nothing. What's in the barn? Nothing. What is it all adding up to? Nothing. Why? Because you've been disobedient. You've sinned against me in so many. Look, your sin is greater than you think. I promise. Like, there's no reason. There's no good reason. There's not even any inkling of a reason why I should bless you. But from this day on, I will bless you. God is saying there is absolutely no reason. Zero, none. There is no reason, not even a small. There's nothing. There's no reason why God should bless them. They have done nothing to earn his favor, including relaying the foundation stones of the temple. They've done nothing. Nothing that they can do. No religious work that they can. Nothing. They are diseased trees that deserve to be uprooted and torn down. The New Testament talks about that, thrown into the fire and burned. They are sour, unleavened bread that deserves to be discarded, thrown away in the trash. It's not useful. They're like bad water. They deserve to be poured out. They will pollute the people that ingest them. But God chooses to bless them anyway. God chooses to bless them anyway. And this morning, Village Church, I want you to consider this. Would you consider the grace of God? Would you consider the unmerited favor of God? Would you just stop for a moment and think about the weight of your sin? But would you move on and would you stop for a moment and would you think about the weight of his grace that's so much greater than your sin? Would you think about his unmerited favor toward you? And if you're not yet a Christian, if you don't yet know and follow Jesus, this is what we believe as Christians. Like, we believe that there's nothing we can do to earn God's favor or approval. How could we? God is holy and perfect, and we are holy and imperfect. but that God sent his son, the person of Jesus Christ, to live a perfect life that we could never live, and to die on the cross and in our place and for our sins, to take the penalty for our sin on himself, and to give to us, to exchange for us, his righteousness. This is the one place where righteousness is communicable, where it's exchanged. This is the only place where it's exchanged. That we get the righteousness of Christ as he gets our unrighteousness put on him on the cross. And every other religious system on the face of the planet believes that you earn your approval with God. You earn something. It's a merit-based system. To one degree or another, whatever degree that it is, it's there. And it's not there in Christianity. That has nothing to do with Christianity. As Christians, we believe that it's the unmerited favor and the grace of God alone. And that's it. Village Church, I want you to consider the grace of God this morning. You know, there are all kinds of people that talk about the grace of God, all kinds of great quotes, things that kind of catch our attention or help to ground us. I picked one this week because it mentions the longing for Egypt. And I feel like it's connected to this idea that in Haggai that they were coming into the Feast of Booths and they were celebrating the exodus from Egypt and the wilderness years. And I just felt like, man, it just so resonated with where we are right now. And it's from Charles Spurgeon. And Spurgeon says this, if you just, maybe you would even just close your eyes for a minute and just think about this. He says, soar back through all of your own experiences. So maybe you would just bow your head and your heart and in your mind, just for a moment, you would soar back through all of your past experience. And think of how the Lord has led you in the wilderness and has fed and clothed you every day. How God has borne with your ill manners, your ill-deservedness, your ill-famed life. And put up with all of your murmurings and your longings after the sensual pleasures of Egypt. Think of how the Lord's grace has been sufficient for you in all of it. Feel the church, at the end of the day, this is what makes him the famous one, is his grace toward sinners. His grace toward sinners. Look, your sin is greater than you think it is. I promise you it is. God's grace, though, is greater than that. It's greater than your sin. I promise you it's greater than your sin. He's saying, I promise. And his third promise that all of this leads to is this: I will do greater things than you think. I promise. I will do greater things than you think. I promise you I will. If our sin is greater than we think, and yet God's grace is greater still, how can he not also do greater things around us and through us than we think? Greater things than we think. I mean, if our sin is that big, but his grace is bigger yet, is greater yet, like how could he not? Why? How could he not do greater things than we could ever imagine around us and in and through us? I think sometimes we don't believe God will do great things around us and through us because we fail to recognize the great things he's already done in us and for us. That's why I want you to look at the grace of God this morning. What are the things that he will do? He tells them two things. One, he will do great things around us. He'll do great things around us like he would do great things around them. Look at what he says he's going to do, starting in verse 20. The word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the same day, the 24th day of the month. Speak to Zerubbabel. And I want you to just pause for a moment and see, like, this gets really personal. So every other time he's saying, hey, talk to Zerubbabel, talk to Joshua, and talk to all the people. And this time he just says, talk to Zerubbabel. I want you to feel how personal that this is getting for Zerubbabel. And I want you to feel how personal this needs to get for us and for you right now, in this moment. Now, there are implications for all of them for sure through what will happen through Zerubbabel, but this is getting really personal and it's clear to see. And so hopefully this would get really personal for you. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I am about to shake the heavens and the earth and overthrow the throne of kingdoms. Look, I'm about to destroy the strength of the heavens and of the nations, to overthrow chariots and their riders. Look, and the horses and the riders, they're going to go down, and every one of them, how? By the sword of their own brother. Here's what he's saying to them. Look, right now, Jerusalem is in a very understated place. A very understated position. Look, the walls are broken down. The people are depressed. They're longing for a different day. The temple is in ruins. The foundation stones are burnt. Their enemies are threatening them. Like, they are in a very, very understated place. But here is what God is saying. He's saying, over the course of time, and in due time, follow me, and at just the right time, he will do something far less understated in that place, and the world for that matter, than they could ever imagine, and in a way they would never expect. That God would turn kingdoms against themselves, that he would pit brothers against themselves, that one army would take down itself, they would turn on one another. Like, he has the power to make an army turn in on itself. He can do the unexpected at the right time, at the proper time, over the course of time. And maybe like me, sometimes you feel like you're part of something that is very understated in this place. In this place, I mean in our city, like you see all the people moving here from all over the world for a better education and for better salaries and a better way of life. They're out kayaking and mountain biking and running and doing all these things as we speak, enjoying the sun. They're, you know, kind of traveling all over California and doing all that they do. This is they're here for themselves. They're here for pleasure and for leisure and for recreation and for money and for status and for jobs. And how are they ever going to see God? How are they ever going to see who he is? How is he ever going to do something great in this place where everyone is so greatly turned away from him and not toward him, so greatly concerned about all kinds of other things? And we're just like a few hundred people in a church literally behind a dog park, and this is a city of 250,000 people and a county of hundreds of thousands of people. Like, how in the world is God going to do something great right here? I don't see it. I think the promise for us this morning is that over the course of time, follow me, and in due time, and at just the right time, God can and will do something far less than understated around us than we could ever imagine, and in a way we could never imagine. I mean, look, there could be a day by God's grace where there are all kinds of gospel-centered churches all around this city and county, where there are village churches all around this city and county, where there are thousands of people that are following Jesus, worshiping him, making his fame and his renown known, hundreds of community groups and church planters going out and people being sent out to neighboring cities and all over the world. Your neighbors knowing more of who Jesus is, people coming to know him like never before, baptisms like we haven't seen in ages or decades. Like, God can move this way in ways that we would never expect. The question is, do you believe that? In Village Church, I want to tell you that you may not see all the great things God will do in this place in your lifetime. And they could not see all the great things God would do in their lifetime, but they were willing to trust God by faith anyway. And the question is, are you? Are you willing to trust that God will do some great things in your lifetime, but that God, by his grace, might even do greater things in the lives of your children and your grandchildren in this place? That this church has been around for over 30 years and God has done things, great things in and through this church, and there's been different seasons. And about 8 years ago, this church was kind of rebirthed and replanted and it's another new season. But in another 30 years, could you imagine all of the things that God would do in and through the life of the Village Church? Look, I'm not preaching here today and I'm not coming alongside to help pastor you for the next year or 10 years. Like, look, we're here for 10 or 20 or 30 years. Like, we're here for a long time. Long obedience in the same direction for the sake of God's fame and what he wants to do in this place. Can you get a glimpse of that this morning? The second thing he says is he will do not only great things around us, but he will do great things through us. He says, on that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and I will make you like a signet ring. For I've chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts. Look, not only is the city of Jerusalem a very understated place, but Zerubbabel himself is in a very understated place. He's a very understated person right now. And it might not seem that way because as Haggai's speaking, he's like, hey, tell Zerubbabel, tell Joshua, and then tell all the people. So he seems really far removed, like he's really, really, really important. And guess what? He used to be. He was in line to be king before they were taken to Babylon, and now he's governor. It's kind of like he's supposed to be the Orange County sheriff, and he's Paul Bart Mall cop. That's kind of what's going on here. Like he took a real step down. And the people in Haggai's day, like, they would feel this. They would feel the weight of this because they knew who he was. They knew his bloodline. They could see the understated nature. Like a guy that's like taking a step down. He's kind of defeated in some ways. He's low. And yet God says that over the course of time, and in due time, at just the right time, he will do something so far from understated through him. He says he's going to make him a signet ring. That signet ring is like that big Super Bowl ring, like the big one, you know, that they'd wear, that they'd have their seal on, and it would be like, hey, this is the family seal. And so it's all about love and authority. So you read the story of the prodigal son, and he comes back, and he gets the robe and the ring. It's all about love and authority. And so what God is saying is like, I love you, and I'm going to demonstrate my authority through you, through your bloodline. You know that Zerubbabel is a progenitor of Jesus Christ. Jesus will come through his line. Like that's the way that the Messiah, that's the way Jesus is going to come. And maybe this morning, like me, you have had seasons where you feel very understated. Like I pretty much feel understated all the time. I feel in a low place. You feel like I'm an understated person. Like, look, there's no superheroes here. There's no superstars in this room. I mean, I like you guys, but like we are an understated people in an understated position, like Zerubbabel. But I think the promise for you this morning is this, is that over the course of time, and again, follow me, over the course of time, in due time, at the right time, God can do something far less than understated through you, far less understated than you could ever imagine. And you may not see all the great things that God will do through you in your lifetime right now. If you're like me, you walk in and you look at your kids at night and you pray for them and you pray, oh God, would they know you in deeper ways than I do, right? I mean, you pray that stuff, right? Oh God, would they love you more than I do? Would you use their life in greater ways than you use mine? Like, would you make your fame known through their life in greater ways than through mine? I mean, you pray that kind of stuff for your kids, right? You know that like this is what we want for our children. This is the hope that we have. Could you imagine the hope that God has for the things that he will do, not only in and through our lives now in this season, but the lives of our children and grandchildren? I mean, all of the kids that run around and make mayhem at this place right after we sing the last song. I mean, could you imagine what Jesus Christ can do in and through their lives in the next generation? You might not see it in your lifetime. You might only see part of it in your lifetime. We might only see a glimpse of the great things that God wants to do. Are you willing to follow him and to trust him by faith anyway? Believe him for even greater things in the lives of your kids and your grandkids, no matter how understated everything seems or feels. As the band comes and we get ready to respond, I want to invite you just to close up your Bibles, close up your journal, power down your iPad, Just get settled. Bow your heads and your hearts with me. If you're new with us at The Village, we respond by receiving communion, remembering Jesus' body broken for us, his blood shed for us. We respond in these times by singing songs to Jesus. We believe that he alone deserves it. We give of our tithes, our offerings. You know how to do that either here in the back or online if you're part of The Village. But could I ask you just to bow your head and your heart with me? And I want to point your attention one more place this morning if I can. I want to remind you that ultimately God did the greatest thing in the history of the world through perhaps the most understated person in the history of the world. And I think you know who I'm talking about. Haggai's one of the minor prophets. It doesn't mean that he's less important than a major prophet. One of the major prophets, Isaiah, describes the person we're all thinking about in this way. For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. Jesus Christ is the most understated person in the history of the world. They said things like, isn't this just Joseph and Mary's son? They asked him to leave his hometown. They scorned him and they mocked him. He took a larger step down, an infinitely larger step down than anyone has or ever will. He is at the very same time the famous one and the understated one. But Isaiah goes on to say this, but he was pierced for our transgressions, and he was crushed for our iniquities. And upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. And all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.
Spirits fed.